Jai Ma. Yes, so divine wisdom teaching us to stay mute because we are in the presence of something very vast and tremendous. Actually, if we look at this world last century and especially the last 50-60 years, one thing we cannot miss is that there are unprecedented things happening all over. And just to note a few things before we enter, entry into the subject itself, that the generation is changing. Now, we will not judge whether it is good or bad because that depends on the standpoint. But it's changing in one sense, it's getting free from the past burden or the burden of the past. This we can see for sure. Which direction is it going, whether it's going into a higher direction or a lower direction, depends on how we look at it. But definitely there is a cry for change. And this change is multiplying through the generations. Each generation is as if taking a leap forward. So this is one thing which is very evident. Also, there has been overall in the world a lot of unrest. Not that the world was ever in a state of complete rest, but the kind of unrest and the global unrest which is taking place is unprecedented. Something which Shurbindo has passingly mentioned in one of his poems, In the Moonlight, in 1900, where he says, "The Iron Age has ended. Only now the last fierce spasms of a dying world shall shake the nations, and when that has passed, earth, cleansed of its ills, shall raise a fairer brow." So there is an unrest which, if we look at it from the deepest standpoint, this unrest comes whenever there is a great transition taking place. And as the mother said, Shubhendu used the word labor pains. These are the labor pains of a new world, because the old world has reached a point where it must burst forth into something new or else collapse. So this is what we see witnessing all over the world. People want change. They don't know what really they are looking for, just like a baby in the womb wants to come out. But where, what? So certain terms have started floating, and these terms have their own meanings, and therefore we must be very clear what we are speaking of when we use the word spiritual evolution. So spiritual word, generally when we talk about the word spiritual, there is one of the meanings that comes in the human mind is pertaining to God or the spirit. But the problem is human mind has so far defined God and spirit in a certain way, a mental way, depending on its angle of vision. But spirit transcends all our definitions. It is at once beyond and at once in the heart of everything. At once everything is the spirit. So we must understand that our limited terminology when we use words like God doesn't help us. That's why the mother would prefer the word divine. Even Sri Aurobindo would prefer the word divine. We'll not go into this more than that. But the word spiritual here means, one way we understand it, religious. So religion deals with the world of gods and cosmic powers, and these are great powers. It is not to deny that these powers don't exist. Even logically we can understand that if you look at the world and its complex working, even in the human body, the way it functions, we are compelled to even logically draw a conclusion that there are perhaps more powers than we can reckon with which are working in the cosmos. And each age of mankind has found its way to understand these powers, to deal with them, and to find a way to activate them, to make this world better by their intervention. So these are the cosmic powers. Even modern science in certain ways does that, but we'll not enter into that other part of it. So basically, spirituality is often understood as appeasing certain cosmic powers, which is what religion is about. But there is a difference between religion and spirituality, because religion, the power is still outside us. There is something which is outside, something which is beyond, and man has to form a kind of relation with these cosmic powers, has to pray to them, appease them by certain formulas and formulations, and then they grant us something like the Vedic, yagya. But there is the, in spiritual age of mankind, the power we have to discover is within us. And that's why, you know, it's very interesting in Sri Aurobindo's, one of the masterpieces, The Mother. He describes the four aspects of the Divine Mother. Now, in India, we know. So, we automatically, you see, knowing too much is a big problem. So, you know, we imagine, oh, Maheshwari, Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, Mahasaraswati. We are conversant with it. Which Purana it is there, which, you know, who has mentioned, who has not mentioned. It's not about that. Look at what Sri Aurobindo is revealing to us. Now, when he describes Maheshwari, he talks about certain intrinsic psychological and spiritual truths. She exists. But at the same time, he is describing to us, revealing to us that how we can approach her. There is nothing which is outward. He is not saying that offer this flower, go and do this prayer. But he is saying to, let's say, grow in whiteness, equality. All this is to make the power of Maheshwari become more and more, close to us, intimate to us, and her working more and more clear in our mind and even other parts of our being. Similarly, he speaks about Mahakali. What does he say? He speaks about being straightforward, you know, being truthful, being honest. And then when we are ready for, when we grow in consciousness this way, so then her action becomes very swift and we can take leaps instead of a slow, tardy evolution. He speaks about Mahalakshmi, he speaks of beauty, harmony, love of a very, very humankind, but in that humankind it's uplifted to what heights. And Mahasaraswati speaks of perfection. So basically, when these cosmic powers whom we have in all cultures in some way or the other, we have worshipped outside us, and waves of time came, there was a time when they were worshipped, then, you know, they all went away and there was one God, but that one God was somewhere above. So to cut a long story short, ultimately we are entering an age when we have to awaken and realize these powers within us. So this is the first step, that if evolution has to take place, it cannot be by something only outside us, but by something within us. And that's why it's very interesting that Sri Aurobindo, often people ask that, you know, what is the initiation in this yoga? Who is the guru in this yoga? So very interestingly, he doesn't give an external initiation. And he speaks of the inner initiation, which is basically awakening of the aspiration. So aspiration awakens because the guru within us has touched us. So he uses the word Jagat Guru in that sense, that he is all around, all over in the world, and he touches us from within. He is hidden in the heart of the creature, and from there he initiates and starts. So it changes our complete understanding of, in religion there is God outside, everything is outside. Even certain conventional religions, he is not just here in the cosmos, but beyond the cosmos. But here is God within us. This is the first thing to be recognized, as the mother says in one of the earliest writings. The first thing we need to understand is that the source dwells within us. And doesn't matter what name we call him and what name we relate to him, her, or whatever way, but we can relate to that divine. This is important, because it's not just an impersonal. If we take it that that is an impersonality which dwells everywhere, then there is no question of evolution or transformation. We create a division between our consciousness, which is, call it that or whatever, and this world as it rolls, and there is no connection between the two. That kind of a spiritual philosophy obviously cannot help us in the evolutionary process. Spiritual evolution is possible only if we admit and accept that that consciousness which is beyond, that is also within and is the secret driver of everything upon earth. Secret driver, and it gives us tremendous hope, because it's like a seed, and it's also something which is surrounding us and pushing us. Recently, in one of the webinars, somebody was saying that when we look at the world, what do you feel about hope? So I said, hope is always there because it doesn't depend on human beings. Problem is, if we look at hope because of human beings and what's happening outside, then yes, we can conclude hastily, oh, there is a lot of hope or no hope, depending upon a bill which has been passed in some parliament or not. But hope is not there. Hope is because the divine consciousness is embedded within us. And this divine consciousness is emerging. It's not just embedded as a sakshi, as a witness presence, doing nothing, waiting for us to come out of the illusion. It is pressing upon us. And then when we look at life with this just one thought in our head, or in our heart that there is the divine within us and he is pressing, he is the most important player, he is the doer, then life begins to change. Because whatever we may be doing, wherever we are going, the first thing is that let's connect with this which is within us, which is omniscient, omnipotent, source of everything, which is all love, all benediction, all ananda. Then immediately half the maladies of the world are treated, because now we are not looking for something from outside which we must get within us. We are carrying the source within us. And I think even if this we live, it can change a lot of problems in life, take them away. Because often, I mean, as a psychiatrist, I see people who suffer. Why? Because they say, you know, there's a problem, I love someone and someone doesn't give love to me. But the moment you discover that love is within you, then you are a natural giver. You're not looking for anything outside. You give because love is inside us. It's not something from outside. Similarly, a lot of things, people rush into drugs and rush into, you know, the modern, sorry to use the word in a very generic sense, pop culture, where you're looking for joy, somewhere you will get, but here the source of joy is within us. See, this one understanding changes anything. Then for peace, we are looking for outer circumstances. Well, source of peace is within us. And in one word, this source of peace, joy, love, wisdom, all of this within us is called as the divine within us. Now, it's not like these are separate deities. Like in religion, for each one, there is a separate deity. Just to, you know, many of us from Indian background would remember, we have these mantras like Ya Devi Sarva Bhuteshu Shakti Rupen Sanstita. So we are invoking the Divine Mother in the form of Shakti. Then there is another mantra, Ya Devi Sarva Bhuteshu Shanti Rupen Sanstita. Then Vidya Rupen Sanstita. So we are invoking each aspect of the Divine, which is, what is the age of the gods? That's what Mother is saying, that age of the gods was, in some way or the other, we were invoking each and every aspect of the divine, or, you know, they were governing life as if you are this or that. But where does the age of truth begin? When we discover that the source of all this is within us. So what is the new invocation of the Divine Mother in this yoga? It's Om Anandamayi Chaitanyamayi Satyamayi Parame. She is one. And all these powers, forces, beings belong to this one. Call by whatever name she understands. There are such beautiful letters to the mother. How intimate she has become. So she uses words like, my baby. Then the child means the grown-up man who is a sadhak is writing to her, my sweet mama. Now, there is all kinds of relationships. So here the initiation is within, and the guru, when will we begin to wake up to this? When we realize that the divine is the guru, which is who is within us, carrying us. So the first effort of spiritual evolution, first effort, because we rush into intellectualizing things, is to discover this divine presence within, without which there is no second step, no further step. We may intellectualize and understand anything. So, second thing apart from religion is that we should not mistake spiritual evolution with occultism. Occultism is a lot of powers of different kinds which will wake up in nature. But there is a difference between wrestling these powers by the method of the tantra forcibly and awakening to these powers and possibilities, or these powers waking up within us as a result of the working of the grace in whatever field we are active. Say, for example, that, you know, if one is a healer, so the awakening of this power should give us a very natural healing process, which is yet supernatural. It doesn't have to be through some special processes. See, special processes are ways by which we are trying to catch hold of, if I may use the term, these powers, please them. And so these powers become operative in our life. But the natural process, and I have seen this happen, see it happening, that when these powers begin to awake, and how they will awake in whatever field we are engaged in, whether we are speaking, healing, cooking. I'll give just one example of, you know, in ashram context, there was Chandradeep ji. His task was to give letters. You know, when the letters would come, he has to say that this has to go to this sadhak, this has to go to this sadhak. Wonderful person. I had the good fortune of meeting him, and That moment there was some question, not in my, because I had just had an experience and he immediately said something intuitively which was true. So now he would take the letters and he would not read for whom they are there. He would start sorting them out. And if somebody is seeing, would wonder what is he doing. Because this was the work which he was given and the intuitive faculty was completely operative. Not a single letter he will pick up and see that whose letter it is. And it will be correct, exact. So now it's not this or that power, but whatever work we are doing. Because this is the work given by the divine. And when we take it in that attitude, the power, the strength, the energy, everything should come. I have seen people working in the dining room like that. So this is the first thing which will happen, is that occultism about special practices and the powers by which we appease the powers. Instead of that, the powers awaken from nature sleep as to whatever is needed. And this is going to happen in the newer generations. Right now we are still facing whatever Gen Z or Gen Alpha or whatever. Many of this will be washout generation, I'm sorry to say. But they will be intermediary species. You can't help it, because any evolution requires many intermediary species. Mother has spoken about it. She spoke about aborted species. And yet they are breaking away. They are doing a great work. The great work is they are breaking away from the past. And doesn't matter which way they are going, because right now these are the experiments of nature. And through which, of course, this is not to be seen with a touch of sadness. No. The souls which take this break free, and slowly the same souls come in newer body, gaining the experience, and eventually they will get into that intuitive and the suprarational phase. The third thing which we should not mistake spirituality when we talk about spiritual evolution is high intellectuality or idealism. Many times we mistake it for moral, ethical idealism. Well, we all know, good as these things are, they are not what the spiritual consciousness is. Spiritual consciousness acts on the basis of an intrinsic freedom. Whereas morality is a convention, very high convention. Maybe, it helps to maintain a kind of social standard, but we must understand that the spirit does not act on that basis. And very often, at least in the Indian context, I keep saying that people understand Ram, but to Krishna they pay only a lip service. So they like to talk about Gita, but in Krishnila, only thing they understand is the Rasleela. Because Krishna breaks the formats. He doesn't come into the neat picture of a moral person. And he came to break the formats. He came to say that what is truth, act according to the law of truth. So when we say that today's children and the coming ages will see us going beyond the format of morality, conventional morality, and even more, even conventional ethics, because morality is still something lower. Here somebody else has decided this is right or wrong society, but ethics is something which is within us. The sense of the beautiful, for example, is ethics. But even that will be transcended. We'll be governed by what is called as the law of truth, which doesn't act according to the format or any boundary. That's what is true freedom. Not the freedom that I'll do whatever I feel like, but the freedom to be what the divine presence within us wants us to be. And that's why the Gita closes where Sri Aurobindo has to start. That's one of the connections between Sri Krishna and Sri Aurobindo. The Gita closes by saying, Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam raja. It says, surrender all things to me, take refuge in me alone. And then he says, Aham toha sarva pape bhyo mokshishyami masucha. I'll deliver thee from all sin and evil and fear. So in the new age, in the spiritual ages of mankind, we'll see that kind of inner freedom, which means outwardly a state of what may seem like anarchy, but not anarchy as we understand, but a spiritual anarchy. In the sense that each one is living by his law of truth. So there is no conflict or confusion. In fact, if we look at the Indian understanding of the four ages of mankind, Satyug is a stage like that. Satyug is a stage when the divine manifests in the heart of all creatures, the Yajna Purusha. So there is a kind of anarchy. Anarchy in the sense you don't need an external system. Why? Because each one is following the law of truth. Now, the only thing we can say is that, for example, you are going on a road. One is that everything you are doing based on a certain principle or law. But there are plenty of moments when you have to act based on what you inwardly feel is the right or the true thing. This is beginning to emerge. There is a clash and conflict between fixed ideas, social standards, ways of life, political ideas and ideologies, all the camps in which humanity has divided itself, and the truth which is emerging. There are children today, if you ask them, are you right or left or center? They will laugh at you. They'll say, please don't put me in a slot. I know such children. And they have good of the world in their heart. But if you put them in a slot, forcibly you force fit, you are creating a conflict where there is none. Because everybody wants to do good to the world. Because that is the common ground on which we all, humanity, meet. That, well, we are all interested in doing good to the world. That we all have a common origin. So these are the ways through which spiritual evolution will start, will proceed. So one is that we must be careful. The word spiritual is not religious. It transcends religion. It's not occultism. It transcends occultism. It's not intellectual, but it transcends intellectuality. It can use all the three for its expression. By transcending means it doesn't deny. For example, some people believe I am spiritual, not religious, means when I stand before, let's say, the samadhi, I'll not bow down because I'm spiritual. That is silly. Well, you can do this. You can equally do it to a child. One little example of Nolida once. So, the person was telling me, he himself was there. He says, I went and there were people going to Nolida, and he was in a conflict whether, you know, I should do pranam or not. Rightfully, because, you know, I have gone through this, that I will bow down only before mother, nobody else. When I saw Champak Lalji, I don't know what happened. So he was standing in front of Nolnida, and he thought, I will not do any pranam. So as he goes, Nolnida stood up and he says, you can do pranam to the supreme in me. He was shocked. He never expected that. He has read his thoughts. He knows. And then he does pranam. He says, you don't have to do pranam to me. You are doing pranam to the supreme in me. Now it gives us a new basis of, you know, fraternity, of social bonding, if I may say so. It's not you and me coming together and forcibly trying to accept each other's differences and come together as, you know, either a religious bond or a communist bond, but simply because we are all children of the divine. The divine dwells in all of us. And then we come back to this beautiful gesture of doing pranam. To whom? To the divine in you. Who is doing the pranam? But this is not an intellectual process. It will lose its meaning. If it becomes an intellectual process, it can become a hypocrisy. But a spontaneous gesture. Very often you will see in Pondicherry, and I remind people that, see, this is a spontaneous gesture many people here make. So don't misunderstand them. When you meet them, they will just touch their heart and say, whatever, good morning. They are not doing this, they are not doing this, because somehow, instinctively, I myself picked up this without, from, not from anyone, but very naturally. Later on, I understood that, why do I do this? Because somebody asked me. I said, I had never asked myself. Then I realized that, well, this is it. That's it. It's understood. We are one deep inside our heart. That's the basis of unity. We can't have unity by any other means. Associations, calling together, interfaith dialogues and religious get together. No, because religion divides. It can't help it. It is only possible when we go back to the source, that the divine presence in you and within me are same. So this is how spiritual age will proceed. First is divine presence is in me. Then it is in mankind. Why mankind? In every creature. That's how the mother says that, you know, sons of God. So in every creature. So why shouldn't I not treat the stone, the tree, everything with this truth that this is the divine presence, river? Then if we do it, nobody has to teach us how to deal with things. Because spontaneously, when there is the divine element within everything, we must treat it with love and respect and care. So the whole life becomes from within outward. So this is the spiritual evolution. It's not a sect or a system where there is an imposition of a belief or a magic mantra which is given and people have to chant it. It is something to be awakened into. So this is the thing I could go on, but I am suddenly reminded we should have more questions answered. I'll just read a passage from Sri Aurobindo. So, and the mother. There are so many passages. This subject can be seen from so many angles. First thing required is, when you open to the spirit within you, it brings you a first foretaste of that higher life, which alone is worth living. Then comes the will to rise to that, the hope of reaching it, the certitude that this is possible, and finally the strength to make the necessary effort and the resolution to go to the very end. First is to contact the divine consciousness within us. And repeatedly she will say that all mental constructions, external things, material efforts are vain, futile, if they are not entirely consecrated to this light and force from above. The motive should change. We are doing the same things. A spiritual person does not do something. This idea must go. Spiritual person must wear a saffron or, I don't know, white color or green color or gray color. I don't know what color. That's not important. It is his inner being is colored. And everything that he does, the most ordinary seeming activity. One of the things that it's a lesson I again remember, first task that I did in the ashram was cleaning the plates. And went there with a very big idea that I am a, you know, whatever, wing commander, doctor in the Air Force. And I felt proud about doing this work. And instantly mother had a way. This is some 30 years back. And the person who was working with me, and I am trying to be outwardly very humble. And yes, yes, we are all friends. Suddenly he took the plates for me and said, this is not how they are washed. So I said, okay, what do I do? He picked up the plate. I still remember that scene. 10 plates with one hand he grasped, he picked up. And when he threw into the water, it was music. He was playing a piano. I tried for 20 days doing it. I couldn't do. I said, what is the secret? He said, practice. Amazing. I mean, it was yoga. Material yoga. He was just picking up the plates and doing. He was an unlettered person. And I was so impressed. I said, my God, I can't do it even thinking that I should do it like that. So spirituality is everywhere. Spirit is everywhere. This idea that I'll sit in meditation and I'll have some mala around and they will be disciples. This is all nonsense. It's gone. Sri Aurobindo himself, there is a reason, many reasons why he didn't use any term like Mahayogi, all this before his name. When people tried to put that before his name, he said, no, simple Sri Aurobindo is enough. Sri Aurobindo is his full name. Of course, we should respect him, but not in the conventional way. The best respect we can ever give, homage, is to live those teachings. What happens in traditional spirituality? Everybody goes, listens to a lecture, comes back, very nice. We had an example in Delhi ashram. Taradi's father recounted this story. The late Surendranath Johar, that there was a businessman and a lawyer, and they used to come every Sunday to listen to satsang in Delhi ashram. So one day there, the businessman's 14-15 year old son or 16, he said, dad, I also want to go today. So the businessman gave him a tight slap, telling you a real story narrated by the person who was present. So the lawyer said, sir, why are you doing this? It is something very nice. He's asking. He said, no, you don't understand, Vakilji. We listen, but we understand what we should put in practice, what we should not. He is a young boy, impressionable. He will start putting into practice that speak the truth and all this. I don't want him to be corrupted at this age. This is the double standard and hypocrisy of religions. I don't want him. I want him to lead this normal life there for old people. This old age spirituality is gone. These children are going to break it. Massive barrier breakers. So we just come back to. So she says we have to open to that. That's all she says. And what is required is The only true effective attitude is an attitude. It's a perfect, total, fervent giving of our being to that with a capital T, which is above us and which alone has the power to change everything. When you open to the spirit within you, it brings you a first foretaste of that higher life which alone is worth living. Then comes the will to rise to that. And then, Sri Aurobindo, from the human cycle, since that is the base, so he speaks about that there are two conditions which are necessary. And with that, we'll stop and open to questions. This is, as I said, it's a very vast and at the same time very complex subject. You can approach it from several angles and reach that same conclusion. So I'm just letting it flow from the angle where it has come naturally. Therefore, even one can open to this purely from the materialist angle and reach the same conclusion. So that will be, you know, entering into too many territories. Therefore, if the spiritual change of which we have been speaking, this is Sri Aurobindo from the human cycle, is to be effected, it must unite two conditions which have to be simultaneously satisfied but are most difficult to bring together. There must be the individual and the individuals, which is where, you know, we have all over the world, there are people, individual and individuals, who are able to see, to develop, to recreate themselves in the image of the spirit. This is the challenge, recreate themselves. Their life should breathe spirit. It should not be that I have read this book and I can quote this book. No, this life should breathe spirit. And then second thing required of an individual is, and to communicate both their idea and its power to the mass. Not just the idea, but there is a power in the idea. What is the power of the idea? It awakens. It's not like people come, listen, and they go back, same, okay, it was nice lecture, Guruji, give us some Ashirvad and my child should get through MBBS. That's not power to communicate. But along with that, and this is important, because very often people say, what is the difference between Sri Aurobindo's yoga and other? There are plenty of differences, but one of them is, it's not a yoga only about individual salvation. Up till now, we speak about individual moksha. And all the communities that have developed, there have been communities, but they're not about collective change of mankind. It's just that when we practice together, it helps facilitate the process of individual moksha, it's individual salvation. But Sri Aurobindo is speaking about something more, and there must be at the same time a mass, a society, a communal mind, or at the least the constituents of a group body. Lagras is one of them. He is beginning to become one of them. The possibility of a group soul which is capable of receiving and effectively assimilating, ready to follow and effectively arrive, not compelled by its own inherent deficiencies, its defect of preparation to stop on the way. So there has to be a group which continues to advance along that light. There will be defect, there will be deficiency. It doesn't stop that, oh no, no, we cannot do it. So it should be the age old, together we can with the help of she. Or fall back from the decisive changes made. For it is into the divine within them that men and mankind have to grow. This is what we started with. It is not an external idea or rule that has to be imposed on them from without. That's why the ashram has no rules. And all over the world, rules are going. Why? Because whatever is going to happen must be authentic. Whatever you are, that which you are inside, that will be expressed outside. Then rest is left to the world forces and their complex working. Either it will be thrown out, or you will be thrown out, or you will evolve, will depend upon that. But not a hypocrisy. The only thing that will be driven out is hypocrisy. Therefore, the law of a growing inner freedom is that which will be the most honored in the spiritual age of mankind. Don't respect me because I am your so and so, or because you will get this advantage. But respect should flow naturally. Nowadays we use the word authenticity, without which it's not like you have to respect just because somebody is elderly. No. True it is that so long as man has not come within measurable distance of self-knowledge and has not set his face towards it, he cannot escape from the law of external compulsion, and all his efforts to do so must be vain. He is and always must be, so long as that lasts, the slave of others, the slave of his family, his caste, his clan, his church, his society, his nation. And he cannot but be that, and they too cannot help throwing their crude and mechanical compulsion on him. This is the unevolved state which humanity is in. But the other tendency has started. We must feel and obey the compulsion of the spirit if we would establish our inner right to escape other compulsion. This is the true spiritual anarchy towards which one day the world will move. We must make our lower nature the willing slave. This is the other important condition. The conscious and illumined instrument, or the ennobled but still self-subjected portion, consort or partner of the divine being within us. How beautiful it is. For it is that subjection which is the condition of our freedom. So the supreme freedom is being a slave of the Lord, to put it in very simple words. All other freedom is an illusory freedom. We are so-called freedom, we are subject to all the currents of the world. Spiritual freedom is not the egoistic assertion of a separate mind and life, but obedience to the divine truth in ourselves and our members and in all around us. So this is Sri Aurobindo, and of course there is so much more, but I would prefer if there are questions so we can cover as many other angles and dimensions as possible. Jema, we can open it for any questions. Yes.
Thank you, Alok, so much for this. This is the most central idea and realization that we understand that everything is manifestation of the divine, even in the most minute, in the most mundane forms. And it is covered by that separated consciousness which is kind of veiling the truth behind it. And once that truth is even wanted a little bit, a little bit aspired for, things are changing immediately. The divine starts participating in minute movements of our consciousness. But what you highlighted was the most important, that individual is to change. Individual is to want to change. And if individuals are not looking for this change, then the societies will continue in the form we have it today, yes, in this format. So Sri Aurobindo in some way was always a prophet of individualism, though he spoke about human unity. Even these, you know, collective meditations, whatever, he was not fond of much. Yeah, he was more about this, your individual work, your discovery, true discovery, which you then bring to the collective, this individual and collective, the major topic of the human cycle, how to reconcile between liberty, free will, and equality, equal opportunities of everyone to grow. And that is absolutely right. It's fraternity or brotherhood, which you highlight as awakening of the inner.
Yes, it will happen inevitably. As the individual grows into the divine consciousness, or individuals grow, fraternity will come about very naturally, spontaneously.
Yes, yes. I mean, we see it in the US, this fight between these two parties all the time, Democratic and Republicans. These are exactly those things Sri Aurobindo speaks in the human cycle. These two, you know, equality, try to reconcile, and they can't because they need a third party or brotherhood finally.
And for that they need to make the ascension. At the mental level we'll only beat the water, but no makhan butter will come out of it. But it's okay, these are necessary stages of preparation. The individual mind churning will ultimately try many methods till it reaches a point where it says, fine, I have to look elsewhere. This is where humanity is moving. So I see hope. People are trying all these methods, like a child tries different ways, till it reaches a point that, no, this is not working. What will work? That is not working. What will work? So it will turn inevitably.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So if anyone...
I think that raising hand function is not enabled, but if you would like to make a comment or a question, and I think Rajan had texted he might, so we would just ask that you put your name in the chat, and we would just call out the name
yes.
as we go through this. But Rajan, did you want to start the Q&A period with a question or comment for Aloji?
Sure, of course. Namaste, Aloji. Thank you very much for this presentation. Wonderful, as always, listening to you. The one question I had came from the Life Divine, where Sri Aurobindo talks about the mass consciousness rising from the inconscient, and then eventually the individual consciousness comes out of it and continues the ascension. But he also talks about the great practical efficiency of the mass consciousness in binding, in building communities, and even some past militaristic states, their efficiency was based on this. In some ways, we call it the herd mentality. He even uses that term. But when you look at the world today, it seems like in order to be a leader, some aspect of that mass consciousness needs to be tapped into in order for that person to have that popularity, right? So it seems slightly that there is a contradiction there. On the one hand, you want that evolution to be there to rise out of the mass consciousness, but on the other hand, for a leader to be a leader, he or she has to tap into the mass consciousness. So I wonder if you could speak to that aspect of how can that evolve into the human unity.
Yes, so the necessity of the individual consciousness, let's put it on the whole axis. So there are four stages through which the evolution proceeds. The first is a kind of anarchic individual, like, you know, a single animal, you know, living for its survival, and at the human level, we may say an egoistic individual run by desires and says, I am a law unto myself. Now, this is the most primitive stage, which we see in, you know, a certain kind of animal kind. Then the next level is that the individual is subordinated to the larger working. It goes to that extent where the individual must sacrifice himself at the altar of the state. At its highest, it becomes the state idea. But then the problem of that is that the individual loses himself completely. So there comes the third stage with which we are navigating today, the child democracy which has sprung up out of all this. Is the individual is important, and while state is there, it has its own importance. It's a kind of trying to find the balance, but the individual liberty is important, though by liberty is understood the ego, and therefore it won't work out. It'll go to a point wherever it allows at least individual exploration to go beyond the limits of religion, to go even beyond the limits of reason for that matter. You know, it's the whole postmodernism, etc., for all its defects, is an effort to go beyond the limits. And then comes, because human beings will go through this experimentation, as I was saying, and it will fail because it's predestined to fail. So the fourth stage is where the happy reconciliation takes place between the individual and the group life. Now this is something which is yet not seen. It is only possible in a Gnostic consciousness. Nalanda once said something very interesting. He said, you know, I'll give an example in context. So Auroville and Ashram and society, they were fighting with each other. All three have a common origin, which is the mother. And Nalanda, when he was asked, because people were trying to reconcile, and he gave a very interesting truth revealed. He said, let individuals grow into the Gnostic consciousness. And then automatically as people grow, they will come together. Now, when I had heard this for the first time, like, you know, any idealist, we all should come together for a moment. But Nalanda had said that. But today I can say that I can totally sync with this. First stress should be for the evolution of the individual into the Gnostic consciousness. As each individual multiplies, so here comes the process, as individuals multiply, the mass has to be a kind of, that's why the ashram, Lagra center, there has to be a kind of, a secluded, not secluded physically, but psychologically, where a kind of, you know, group life develops, but mainly to help the individual evolution. You know, that's what ashram life is meant to do. So this individual grows in his own freedom along his lines. And as individuals, few cross the barrier, they will help many others automatically come. As it is known as the morphogenetic resonance principle, though I am not much fond of that term, but this term has captured the imagination of people. So basically, as individuals advance, it's like a person passes out, there is a vacuum and air rushes in that direction. Wherever, you know, there is a vacuum. So as individuals evolve, they will automatically, because of the law of interconnectedness, pull others. So as of now, the stress should be primarily on individual evolution, and as it happens, so what will be the leader's role? Leader's role is to show the way by example. He is, because he may try external means with state control, police control, legal control, and well, humanity will try all this maybe for another 50 years, my liberal estimate. I am wishing earlier, but he'll realize it doesn't work out because there'll be more and more anarchy. See, that's the interesting part, because the divine consciousness is pressing toward that. And with this anarchy, no system will work. A time will come that no system will work. There will seem to be a breakdown. The leaders, the true leaders will emerge then. The true leaders will not be political leaders, but leaders who have realized something in their consciousness. And they don't have to go and say that, yeah, follow me. That age is gone. They will live the truth. And when they will live the truth, there are many who will follow it. So this is going to be the process as I see it. And as I said, Shubhendra and the mother has spoken about it. So more and more necessity, urgency of spiritual evolution into Gnostic beings, to use the term that Life Divine uses. So Gnostic, we should put all of ourselves in that direction. And the more individuals emerge, because of the interconnectedness and because of the genetic resonance, they will be more and more automatically springing everywhere. This is the law of interconnectedness. We don't need to give really speeches and other things. And then as individuals grow into that consciousness, new kind of polity, administration, law, everything will emerge, which is happening, but at a very, very slow pace. So stress should be in that direction, individual growth into the Gnostic being. And the rest will follow. Because divine is the driver of this evolution, hidden within. Yes.
Thank you, Alokji. Other questions or comments from the group for Alokji?
Yes.
You can just open your mic and ask if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Okay, and if not, maybe I'll go ahead and ask a question, which I think you've answered here and there, Alokji, but, you know, this evolution of the individual to the Gnostic being, you had also mentioned earlier on that Sri Aurobindo mentioned there would be many intermediates.
Yes.
Right now in this transition, and obviously he has written about the Superman and what that being would be like in general. Is there anywhere that he addresses more specifically these intermediate species?
Yes. So specifically about the Superman, because that's one big intermediary. There would be many other intermediaries, but we should know very clearly, because evolution, and thanks for that question, because evolution, when the gates, floodgates open, you know, right from the time of the story of Moses, we can see, when the floodgates open, consciousness will move either upward or downward. This is inevitable, because that's why we see today's children, many times people have a problem, but because these social norms, rules are gone, deliberately they have been taken away. Now you can choose to go upward or gravitate downward. This is now no more an external pressure, but a conscious choice. So it'll create, but because of the increased tremendous power which is now in this atmosphere, also possibilities which science, technology are providing, we will see two lines along which humanity will advance. One will be the Devic or the godlike type, the other will be Asuric type. Shubhendra addresses this in one of his earliest essays on the Superman. So broadly speaking, now I'm not going into semantics of Superman subsequently, as Mother said, but totality of things, when human consciousness evolves beyond the human, one is it evolves along the line of the Asura, greater power, greater knowledge, greater capacity to, well, do good or do harm. But essentially all this greater power, greater knowledge, greater capacity is directed towards self-aggrandizement or aggrandizement of a limited group. So this is where one line, to put it in today's terms. But also there is a godlike supermanhood, which is about a consciousness which is powerful, but very wide. And it has a kind of, as he uses the word, power is there, but it is like benign power. Benign means ki it can have devastating effects, but it's not at the mercy of the ego. It is there, like we know Shobindo's life, so many examples, Mother and Shobindo's life we can see. So that power will grow quietly inside the human consciousness, those who are proceeding along the godlike time. So the sign of this godlike humanity will be wideness, benevolence. And the sign of the Asuric humanity or the Asuric Superman or intermediary species will be cruelty. One of the things will be cruelty. Then another, that extreme selfishness. And of course, there are many things which debase and degrade the consciousness. We all know that. So that is the line along which this will advance. They would be genuine supermen. They are already there actually. Nalinda once said very interestingly, when he was asked about the Superman, he said he may be just right round the corner. So Superman is already there, but well, in different degrees. But equally we must understand that because of his presence, there will be an Asuric kind of effort to completely give it a different orientation. To give the orientation of there have been novels like that where people are forced in doom. That's where Nietzsche comes in. The Superman of Nietzsche, who is a man who struggled for survival, he's the most fittest, and fittest in the sense he's strongest, and he doesn't care for anybody else. But the true sign that evolution is taking place along the right lines is it brings wideness, compassion, love, benevolence, wisdom, but power also, not without power. But this power is not at the mercy of the ego. This power is at the mercy of the divine command. So of course, those who go through the experience understand it much better. But this is the... So there will be many intermediary which would include Asuric types and mixed types and types where inner being is developed. I see more and more so many children or people who inwardly their dreams are suggesting that they are evolving, but the body and the vital is not ready to adapt to it. So a whole life is spent in just, happy dreams or good dreams because the vital and the physical is not ready. So there will be an intermediary type of that where one spent the time dreaming about it but never really realized anything. Then there are those who are having beautiful inner experiences, are connected outwardly, but the mind is not ready. So broadly, Sri Aurobindo spoke of two types of lines along which it will evolve. Now the evolutionary type, one is homo psychicus and the other is homo intellectualis. So homo psychicus is who operates from the depths of the heart through love. And homo intellectualis who operates through higher and higher ranges of the mind. He accepted both. So but homo intellectualis is somebody who is entering into widenesses of the mind, like the Vedic rishis. Whereas homo psychicus is like the later bhakti movement operating from the depths of the heart. And Sri Aurobindo, if you read through that letter, basically it was a letter of Dilip Kumar Roy, he said that, well, while it is true that homo intellectualis will lead to the wider, but how do you know that the homo psychicus will not lead the journey or something like that? So basically it seems that there will be two kinds of broadly category of these human beings. And then there are others who will look like as if they are evolving type, but they are not evolving type. For example, he used the word homo rasalicus with his sense of humor. Whereas there is a intellectual development, but there is not really commensurate spiritual development. So much of this and many other abortive species, after all, between man as he stands today and the earliest effort of chimpanzee or whatever, orangutan to enter into manhood. The first was the Cro-Magnon man. It's finished completely. Australopithecus finished completely. Neanderthals, beautiful beings. I mean, when I had read it, I felt really sad that Neanderthals lost to the Cro-Magnons. But it is a very sobering story. They fought on the plains of Europe and Neanderthals lost. They became extinct. But these were the good guys. It's very interesting. These were the good guys. But over a period of time, everything changed and today we have, and there was interbreeding, all this was there and we have today the modern human. So they were the same, something similar will happen. There will be many subspecies based on where is the stress of evolution. And whoever is not ready to move along, obstinate resistances, it'll just finish. We don't have to worry about it. Nature will take care, the divine will take care. It'll just collapse. There are many ways it will collapse. Fertility rate is one way. It'll, you know, many things will happen. So let me stop at that, this question. So intermediary species which will collapse, yes.
Thank you. Look, that reminds me of this mother's vision of the supramental shape. Can you just kind of bring this topic into what are these beings, half ready, fully ready, shining, who are entering into this shape, this prophetic vision?
Yes, yes. The experience of 3rd February, I think 1950s, late 50s. But there the criteria was very different. So she says that she was on the boat. It reminded me of Noah's Ark, that well, there is a supramental boat because that's a very symbolic ark. And she sees many people who are there on the boat, and there are supramental beings proper. I mean, they are not earthly evolution beings, but beings of the supramental world who are given the charge to see who is ready and who is not ready. She says very interestingly that she was observing that the criteria was not at all what we would conventionally consider religious, moral, like waking up in the morning and doing the, you know, prayers, etc. This was not the criteria. No ascetic practices were the criteria. So she laughed and laughed. The criteria was completely psychological. And then she was asked later on, she then resisted. She didn't say more. Then later on the disciples asked, what is the criteria? And what are the things which were not in consideration? She says the criteria was wideness and plasticity. And as to what was not in consideration, which we think is something very great, but which will not be of any importance in the new creation, she said two or three things. One is the ascetic practices. And second is, you know, so much importance given to marriage, married ones suffered throughout life on earth or whatever, the fidelity in marriage, that's given so much importance in tradition, but the new creation will not work on that lines. It will bring out the truth inside. There is a truth of togetherness, let's put it completely. She is not talking about life being, but to reach that truth, people have to be awakened to the truth inside their heart. So things which we consider very important, practices of marriage, practices of ascetic practices, and you know, that marriage, sanctity of marriage is the word she used, all this will collapse. So what will remain is wideness and plasticity. And transparency, another thing which she insisted, means you don't put up a show, don't try to hypocrisy, try to show off something which you are not. All this will go away. It's already going away. One can see it actually. So if you see from mother's vision point of view, things are already happening in that direction. But strength is required to bear the impact of the spiritual supramental consciousness. Strength intellectual, strength emotional, strength vital, strength physical, at every level strength is required. So it's a power. Otherwise, there will be breakdown. Yeah.
Yeah, there is a question here in the chat. Namaskar Pandeji, thanks for your great points today. What is your view on privacy in superhuman and inner world context? Asuric forces in modern world are primarily anchoring and playing with the privacy in the outer world and costing the human freedom directly everywhere.
I was single, you see, there is a reason why this is happening. And the role of privacy, well, the real answer, and this answer comes from something which the mother once mentioned. Real answer lies in the truth within and transparency within us. So there is nothing to hide of which we can be ashamed of, or we don't want to become public. Something very interesting which the mother once remarked in the ashram context, and now I see it happening all over the world. Now, I'm not saying that these people who are involved in this, they are acting out of their personal interest, but we have to see how the divine action is proceeding. So she said once to a disciple in the ashram context, don't do anything in the ashram which you don't want to do it in public, because nothing will remain hidden here. And in my 25 years of experience of being here, 23 years of living here, and the journey of so many people personally knowing it, it is very, very true. This should not be done. Whatever you are, whichever way you are, it's like you are in a big bathtub where you are taking a bath. Now, when you are taking a bath, you have to undress yourself. If you feel ashamed, then yoga is not for you. In fact, very interestingly, in spiritual life, there are eight bondages which are described. One of them is lajja, sharam, which is regarded as an ornament outside. Shame, feeling of, ashamed because there is something hiding, trying to. So we are living in an age when nothing will remain hidden. So whether it's good or bad is our way of looking at it. But the point is that we should reach a point where, how does it matter? We live a life of truth inside, and let whatever is known is known. It will happen. To put it, this is part of the process, that there is not going to be. I know there are very strong views on privacy and privacy of data and all that. But this is going to happen more and more. A day will come when nothing you can remain. Now, it doesn't mean that everybody will talk about it or reveal it. But we have entered an age, and it is also part of the working of the truth. Nothing can remain hidden. So that means we have to become conscious inside. We have to live life that way. Not that everything will be known to everybody. No, that's obviously it's not possible. But at some point, we have to understand that I must lead such a life that if anything of my life is known to anyone, well, it's okay. Also, people may know, see a fragment and draw their own conclusion. That is also okay. Because people may judge you, it doesn't matter. Because if we are true to ourselves, people who feel very afraid of being judged have problems somewhere. So why be afraid of being judged? People will at some point. I understand where there is a misjudgment in very personal relationship. That's a different thing altogether. That's not misjudgment, but you don't want something to happen when somebody cannot understand. But generally, it's like, yes, you will be misjudged. It's fine. Maybe sometimes people who criticize or critical point out your mistakes are also doing a favor, because they are showing us things which I cannot see. So everything can become a catalyst to our evolution if we look at it that way.
Thank you, Aloki. And I see Chitra, who is with us here. She has typed in a question in the chat. But Chitra, if you could just maybe open your mic and ask Aloki, please.
Yeah, thank you. Namaste, Alokta.
Namaste.
So my question was on, I'm trying to be as coherent as possible and trying to bring in two things. One is, you spoke about family. Mother has said, Mother Sri Aurobindo has written that the concept of family is evolving and it continues to evolve. And you also spoke about some changes that are coming in, like infertility, people choosing not to have children probably. I have two questions. Firstly, for those of us who do have children, we always seem to be on the edge. I think that's my feeling, that we never have the feeling of well, or doing the right job at all. We can be at one extreme or the other, and it never feels like, I don't know, somehow my mom always said, oh, we've done such a good job, your children are well settled, but I never have that feeling with my children. So that is completely disappearing. And second, so my question on family was, like, will this institution continue to have a good role to play in all of this transformation that is happening, or will it just dissolve? My second small question was, in the family institution, conscious conception is something the mother has written about. That's the first thing, to conceive consciously. while on the one hand transformation is causing infertility, even choosing not to have children, but for those who do, will conscious conception take steam? Will it be something that will grow?
Okay. So we'll touch upon all the three. As to the family thing, long back, Khalil Gibran very prophetically wrote, your children are not your children. They are arrows of time shot from the bow of life. So it's so true that every generation must move ahead. Actually, one of, I think, Walt Whitman's poem also, I'm reminded, says, children must move toward the future. So this idea, there are two ways of looking at family. One is that, you know, the family, when it grows up, it must perpetuate me, continue with my way of life and look after me when I am in old age. Now, this is a very, this is counterproductive. Well, family at one level is like, well, it's the initial potting of the tree. So as long as we don't have the supramental way of bringing new beings, we will have a family. But family should change its role from being purely conservative, that, you know, they must inherit traditions, they must walk their way. And we should create a good base, because that's the first family. The first family is the physical family. And even a good genetics, why not? Then the next step is that there is a psychological family. He'll move into the world, discover himself, go through the process and, you know, discover those with whom he is more aligned, go through all that. And then there is the spiritual family, the family of seekers, aspirants, etc. So family exists at many levels, and the physical family is only like the pot which allows a seed to grow in. But the seed must spread far and wide, maybe even repotted. After all, certain trees, when they have to grow much more, they cannot be in the same pot. So this is bound to happen. And the sooner we understand and accept it, the better it is. So this is one part of it. Family has a role, but a very limited role, that, you know, in the beginning, whether we like it or not, children will. But role in terms of giving sanskar, no, be the truth that you want to practice whatever you want to do. Because children are today having X-ray eyes. And I can give any number of examples I know of that don't try to, you know, put up a show and tell them do this, don't do this, whereas you yourself are not doing. They will notice this hypocrisy. I use the word, today's children have X-ray eyes. So don't try to cheat them by, you know, living a lie and trying to tell them to speak the truth. It doesn't work. So we must be living examples even in the family context. But at the same time, we must know that, you know, divine, you know, enjoys infinite variety and diversity. It's the law of creation. So whatever way we go, they go, you know, as parents, our role is a limited role, only after a point. Beyond a point, we are there, but as parents are there, they are always there. But it's not like he must live according to what I want him to be, follow the same religion, do the same thing, you know, follow, let's say, for example, as a Sri Aurobindo devotee, he must be a devotee of Sri Aurobindo. We can bring it everywhere. No, that's not the way. He must discover himself, explore himself, be wide. But at the same time, he must have the confidence that there is someone as our first teacher whom we can always consult. So this is what we need to remember with regard to children. And what was the second question? Is about, yeah?
Sorry. Huh.
Conscious conception. So now, very interestingly, in India, you will be, you know, these are things which don't make news. But there is a place, I have visited that place, and maybe I can mention Sri Aurobindo Dhamma. It's on the banks of Kaveri, and very interesting story you will find somewhere on my YouTube, this thing, on the banks of Kaveri and the hills. So there a person who turned towards Mother and Sri Aurobindo, they are having a whole place which is about conscious conception. So one of them is that, you know, people who want to conceive, they come here and the parents are having a common aspiration and they conceive the child. Though it is still in the traditional sense, but really conscious conception is ultimately we transmit to the children our aspiration or our shadows, sometimes both. So if we have shadows, we may have a conscious aspiration, but sometimes, you know, destiny has its strange ways that we may transmit the shadow. And that depends on the moment of conception. We have an interesting story in the Ramayana that Pulastrishi, he's a rishi, And his wife is a Rakshasi or an Asuri, comes from an Asuric family, not in good or bad terms. Asura in that age meant something else. But Kaikashi, so, she drags him, no, I want to have a child, and he is doing his puja during a certain time, Sandhya, it's not the right time, because this is a time when we have to invoke the deities, but instead of that, you are dragging me into having a kind of, fertility game. So the child who comes, why she wanted? Because she wanted that my husband is just Rishi. I want my son to conquer the world. So she gives birth to Ravan. The second is Kumbhakarna. So then third child, the Rishi says, look here, let's do it in a proper way. So they invoke the presence, they are conscious within them, then they have the child called Vibhishan. So basically it means that even the act of procreation becomes something very beautiful and divine. There is a mother spoken about it. So there are people who are not ready for the still higher law, and yet they are here and they have to invoke, aspire, and their own life should be an example. It's easy to just have a child. Very different, to have to become a parent in the true sense. So this is where, but as to supramental, well, there would be beings who don't want it. And those who are going into the still higher mode, they don't have to get into it. This question was asked to Sri Aurobindo. He said, no, there will be enough beings who will bring children into the world. But there are beings who are going to become switch on to the body. It's a whole subject. Can supramental being create a being out of himself? I have reasons to believe, yes, it's possible. So all that is for the future. So there will be two kinds of humanity. One which is intellectually ready to accept this idea of higher truth, but is not ready to overcome or not mastered all the attachments and, sexual aspects, etc. So if it has to have a child, it should be a conscious conception. But there is a kind of humanity which has gone beyond. They need not engage because the sexual energies have to be diverted towards the higher consciousness. So this is the basic difference. The rate of fertility dropping is, in fact, it's predicted. And the excessive sexual outburst and all that took place in the recent maybe 50 years because of so-called freedom, people felt very worried. But nature has her plan. She's just exhausting what is inside human beings. So by 2063, 64 is a cutoff point. Scientists are speaking that possibly after 65, 2065, we'll start seeing fertility rate dropping so drastically that the mortality rate will be higher. And maybe in another 100, 200 years, we'll actually see the ratio of population going in the backward slide. I mean, not that people don't want children, but because the fertility rate will drop, so they won't have children. So these are things which are very interesting in the sense that nature is conscious. There is a consciousness operating within it. See other ways. And I think one of the results of the excessive so-called sexual emancipation and pornography and everything is to take away the sexual urge or even the, many things in men. And also in women, it's like an exhaustion which takes place. So that's what humanity will go through. That's a different area. That's nature's working in the realm of ignorance.
Thank you a lot. These are really important topics. And of course, in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the last chapter 6, you can find this description of the conscious conception. It's amazing. So beautifully described there, man says, I am heaven, you are earth, let's come together like heaven and earth. So it is the whole ritual of available in Indian tradition of the conscious conception. Most probably it has its own power, and it invokes the soul, conscious soul, to come to the conscious parents. And it's wonderful. These are important topics for the future.
Just as an aside, even sexuality, even that will undergo a transmutation. It will get rid of all animality. It won't be the physical intercourse, but there would be something like a coming together of the masculine and the feminine elements. This is way too into the future, but Sri Aurobindo has spoken about that also.
Thank you so much for this beautiful
Thank you.
Introduction to the most important topic. So we looking forward to meet with you again and to learn from you and with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Jai Ma, Jai Ma.